Since the invention of the wheel, automation has both substituted and complemented labor. Machines replaced humans at some lower-paying jobs, but this was compensated by the creation of new, higher-paying jobs. In other words, tech workers. In recent years, there has been a desire from certain high-profile tech companies for an apolitical workplace. This in itself is a political act, an act designed to suppress the power of tech workers and reinforce the status quo. They know that politics is inextricable from tech, and now, so do you. Welcome to Politics. Ray, I think we need to talk about trust.
Yeah, okay. This is it's one of those chats, is it, where I'm clenching a little bit here. So what's going on?
Well, what I'm getting at is, why do we have such a unwavering trust in technology?
Yeah, that's the big question of the moment, isn't it? Because we have people like Elon Musk and his cohort suggesting that AI can run the government. And we have AI everywhere, with people saying that it can replace jobs, replace doctors, replace teachers, eventually replace truck drivers, all human activity. And I mean, I think there's a few things. I feel like trust is at really the bottom of this, because I feel like in a situation where if we felt like we could trust the people that were making these claims, and you know, if we trusted the claims, so there's several things here, but if we trust the claims and we trust the people, and we trust that it's all in like the interests of humanity, then I feel like this would be great. I mean, these kind of promises would be absolutely like, wow, you know, we really do want to burn the planet down and put all government funding and everything like that into these projects, because they feel like they're absolutely fabulous and utopian.
Yeah.
But obviously we don't trust them to do that, you know. So that's maybe the beginning of it, yeah.
Yeah, like we don't trust them, maybe, but I think it was interesting there that you rattled off a bunch of ifs. If this, if that.
Right.
Unfortunately, I think where we are is those ifs, those kind of ground assumptions have somehow been programmed into our minds. Like, of course, technology is always a progressive force. Of course. So, you know, where did that come from? And this whole idea that computers don't make mistakes, people do.
Well, I think at the end of the day, trust is fundamental to the way that we live our lives, not only as individuals, but you know, as a society. I think trust is everything. You know, if we don't have trust in each other and in the systems, then the whole of society is going to break down. And I think what's happening on one level is that trust in institutions and trust in government and things like that, and trust in the ability for large-scale change seems to be at an all-time low. Mm-hmm. And yet you're right, at the same time, trust in technology seems to be, it's like unbreakable, despite all of the evidence against that in recent times. Now, I want to say that trust is a kind of spectrum, you know, that, you know, we can trust people to do certain things, but we might not trust them with our kids.
Right.
You know, we might not trust them with our most precious possessions, you know. So I think trust is definitely something is contingent, let's say, or it's something conditional. It's never absolute. But, you know, typically we trust that if we've had our wages paid and we put them into the bank, that when we go to spend the money in the bank, it will be there. So that kind of like trust is
right.
Fairly fundamental. But I think we've seen over the last few decades, at least, that trust is not absolute for sure.
Right.
I think we've kind of felt like we were on solid ground, but a lot of that solid ground has become precarious recently.
Right.
And precarity feels like, I would say it feels like the vibe of the moment, the zeitgeist is precarity.
Right.
And I think that breeds distrust. I'm kind of circling around trust in general, but maybe we want to get back to technology. So what do you think about why technology is deemed so trustworthy by the populace, you know, by our colleagues, our comrades, our friends?
That's a great question. I think there are like two parts of that. And one is, why is technology so trusted by the public at large, who are, you know, the vast majority of whom are not technology workers, like we are?
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I want to focus more on is what's going on with technology workers. And the reason I want to focus on that is because, well, first of all, you and I are technology workers, so we can speak from our own perspective without, you know, trying to put ourselves in the shoes of someone who, you know, may know less about this technology. But the other reason is because I think we are kind of at the tip of the spear, both in terms of we are in a way the kind of first people affected by some of this technology. And in another way, like we are the people who can actually do something about this to resist. So why do programmers trust in technology despite all of our experience with writing computer programs that in fact do make mistakes, do get things wrong? Because there is this myth that has been built since, you know, whatever, the 50s or maybe earlier, that computers are infallible, right? People make mistakes, computers don't. But again, you and I know that programmers are humans and we make mistakes all the time. Therefore, you know, we write computer programs that are imperfect. And yet we somehow trust in computer programs that other people who are just like us have written to be perfect. But there is one other interesting angle, and I want to get your thought on this. Let's just stipulate for a moment that computers don't make mistakes. I think a question there is, okay, so computers are perfect. Are they on our side?
Yeah.
Yeah, they are.
Well, I think the general, I mean, of course, who knows? That's to be decided, I think. I mean, you know, you either welcome the overlords or you fight them. Are they on our side is a very interesting question. The central point about technology discussions within technology circles is usually around this idea that technology is kind of neutral.
Right.
That it's a kind of natural outgrowth of the universe and that it can't be considered to be good or bad, essentially. That it's a sort of, it's a bit like mathematics. How can mathematics be a problem? You know, 1 + 1 is never an issue, is it? But I remember, I don't know if you, this is kind of like, we start off on a tangent, of course, but there was the introduction of zero and negative numbers. And that was considered rather dangerous to the early mathematicians, because how can you have negativity in a situation like this? And it was a kind of trick in some ways to resolve some mathematical equations. But it took a long time to get to zero and to negative numbers. It's an extra abstraction over the original evolution of mathematics. The reason why it is worth mentioning mathematics is because when people first think about computing, they think about computers as something that is a mathematics machine, essentially. And they know if you put like a long number into a calculator, 453 times 727, it doesn't have to be that long even. It's long enough. Even if it's like 3 or 4 digits times another 3 or 4 digits, the calculator gets the answer right, and it gets the answer right super quick.
Right.
And so I think that's the basis of all trust for computers, is that people see that they can do calculations very, very quickly, far more quickly than we can, and they will get them more precisely correct than we will.
Right.
I think that's the basis of trust with computing.
Yeah.
Because I think beyond that, most people, we lose a lot of people. When we go beyond like simple arithmetic and stuff like that, the general population sees software and computing as a bit of a black box.
Yeah.
They're trusting that this basic mathematical trick that computers can do can be kind of leveled up beyond that simple trick. Would you think that's about right?
Yes. I think you're really onto something, because I'm just thinking, like, I am really slow at basic arithmetic. I just am. People always, they're like, you're a computer programmer and you don't know how to do math. And I'm like, well, yeah, but math is way more than arithmetic. And, you know, certain types of math I do know how to do.
Right.
And another interesting thing is, like, I think the ability to do arithmetic quickly and accurately is somehow associated with intelligence, right? Like we're like, we see somebody being able to multiply in their head, the, you know, 2 4-digit numbers and quickly get the answer. And we're like, wow, that person is smart. And it's like, well, that person has a skill. But arithmetic is not intelligence. However, like I totally agree with you. For some reason, we humans have decided that it is. And so that one simple trick establishing our blind faith in computers, yeah, I absolutely agree with that. What I would like to do now is go back to, again, the point of talking about trust in this moment. Just to be very crystal clear, we want to talk about AI and why, you know, why we believe that this is a technology worth looking at very closely, and I would just say worth resisting. The reason why I want to resist is not because I think the technology is evil or has no upside whatsoever, but I want to really examine the social impact of this technology, and not only the impact, but also the intentions of the people who are controlling the technology, because that's where the danger lies. There are so many things we could just rattle off, downsides of generative artificial intelligence, your ChatGPTs and so on. You know, we have environmental, we have the quote unquote hallucination problem where ChatGPT just makes up some stuff, but sounds 100% certain of it. That hooks into the whole trust thing there. Just accepting that this technology is inevitable, I think we're doing ourselves and the public a disservice. I am genuinely depressed about is how my fellow tech workers, it seems like so many of them are just like, yeah, we're all in on this generative AI. Like, of course, this is going to change everything. And, you know, we have to, and a lot of times they end the sentence with, and of course, there are downsides. But it's like, yeah, but please let's have the conversation about the downsides as well as the potential upsides.
The issue here is around where the responsibility lies for certain things. So maybe that's a sort of like general stance here. You and I and many other people that we know have a what I would call and what we would call a Luddite perspective.
Yeah.
And in that sense, Luddism is not anti-technology per se. Actually, I think there's quite a lot of benefits to be gained from the concept and the application of artificial intelligence. Whether these particular manifestations of it are good or bad, we'll definitely get into that.
I think we should also unpack, like, not right now, but
There's definitely a lot to unpack, and we'll come onto that in a moment. But I think we should set our stall out pretty early that we're not against artificial intelligence or the concept that it might be helpful to humanity. But what we're interested in is the humane application of the technology.
Right.
We are interested in saying that as long as technology is applied in a humane way for the benefit of humanity, then we can all get behind it. And the interesting question is, who's driving that narrative and who's saying what's in the benefit of humans and humanity? And coming back to trust, can we trust their claims on this particular aspect? And I think we're both very skeptical of both their claims around the technology itself, and you know how it's manufactured and how it's applied, and also the actual application in society of that technology and the dangers that lurk around that. To me, that's kind of like where we're setting the whole conversation here is around trust in the claims of the technology and a trust in the application of the technology. Maybe we need to dig in a bit more deeply into what we would like to talk about in terms of AI and the kind of context of AI today, because I think, you know, as software developers, we've been watching this space for a long time. We know that AI is a bit of a nebulous term, a bit of a fuzzy term.
Yeah.
So should we get into a bit more details about what we mean by it?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you point to AI being this very nebulous thing. And I believe that's intentionally so. As far as I know, where the term artificial intelligence first entered into the general consciousness was back in the late 50s or early 60s, there was a group at MIT, the Artificial Intelligence Lab, and I don't even know if they branded themselves that way from the beginning, but I know that this guy named John McCarthy, who coincidentally is the inventor of the Lisp programming language, submitted an application for a grant to, of course, the Department of Defense, I think it was. And, you know, he wrote artificial intelligence on this, and he is very clear that that was a marketing term.
Right.
Like, he put that term on the application in order to get money from the government.
Mm.
And AI has been a very successful marketing term. It is a huge umbrella of technologies. What people generally mean today when they say the word AI is large language models like ChatGPT or these image generators like Stable Diffusion or whatever. But AI is much bigger than that. And in fact, the biggest dangers of AI are not the emergence of some kind of artificial general intelligence, some superhuman intellect, you know, the machine god. That is not the real danger. I would say the real danger is what is happening with artificial intelligence today. And a lot of that actually doesn't have anything to do with large language models.
In what sense?
So let's just dig into the marketing term a little bit. So I just mentioned the large language models and the image generators and so on. Another form of AI is something that we used to call machine learning. And what machine learning is, they are models that are developed that are very specific to a use case. And now these models are actually responsible for a lot of the bad stuff. So things like you mentioned the British Post Office scandal, where we had a machine learning algorithm looking for fraud. It flagged, I don't know how many postmasters in the UK as having committed embezzlement, basically, right? Stealing money.
Right.
You know, we also have examples where machine learning algorithms have been targeted to detect fraud in welfare systems.
Yes.
So I think in the Netherlands, it kicked a bunch of people off the welfare rolls. Even more recently, though, we need to look at the application of AI systems in, you know, military applications, right? So you have things like the recent reports about these various systems being used by Israel to identify targets. And, you know, what they're looking to do is identify as many targets as fast as possible. The idea is that there's some sort of human oversight, right? Some sort of human review of this. But realistically, in going back to the trust issue that we talked about, you know, the human is inclined to trust the machine.
Yeah, there have been plenty of papers about that, haven't there, about how this concept of the, you know, the human touch, as it were, is somewhat of a fig leaf over what is essentially computer decision making.
Right.
Maybe we can go back just a little bit to dig a little bit deeper into some of these former meanings of AI, because this concept of AI or machine learning, or what I think what people will generally know of as algorithms, because when people talk about like the algorithms on social media and stuff like that, that was a kind of early, or not even an early, but a kind of like widespread adoption of these artificial intelligence training programs.
Right, exactly.
And the interesting thing about that is that it's kind of based on this idea that there's an algorithm which says, oh, if you've seen this program or that program, or you've listened to this music or that music, we will recommend you this other music because, you know, people like you listen to this. You know, it's the kind of like things that Amazon did. You know, if you bought this, people also who bought this, people also bought that. Spotify will do these sort of playlists or these recommendations where, so these kind of things, these kind of like recommendation systems have been known for a long time and with various degrees of success, let's say. You know, some of these recommendation systems are pretty bad, but some of them can feel almost spooky.
Yeah.
in that they can hit a particular nerve where you were thinking about something, and they can recommend something that actually is correct.
Yeah.
So it can, I think that kind of, like, let's call it magic, because I think some people feel a bit like that either their computer is either spying on them,
right,
or is like magically pre-thinking what they were thinking. I think that's the earliest manifestation of these algorithmic machine learning, artificial intelligence models that are sort of saw widespread adoption.
Yeah.
And I know you've got some takes on that because, you know, you've been involved in some of those companies.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting insight. And this also goes back to, you know, what you talked about earlier with trust. Like, if we look at, so let's just start with Amazon. So I did, you know, full disclosure, work there. I have not been involved in any of the machine learning stuff at Amazon, none of the recommendation systems or so on. But I think that's a great place to start, because these customers who bought this also bought that. As a user of Amazon, I feel like that's great, right? Because the algorithm is showing me stuff that I actually am interested in. So it feels to me as a user like the algorithm is on my side. Now, obviously enough, as a worker at Amazon, I saw the other side of it, which was this algorithm is very much not on the side of users, right? Uh-huh. This algorithm is designed to drive sales.
Sure, sure.
That's kind of obvious if we zoom out and think about it for a minute. But it feels like, you know, the algorithm is a trusted assistant.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it is the librarian or the knowledgeable bookstore clerk who is, oh, you know, you have this Michener book. Well, you're really going to love, you know, whatever this other book is.
Well, I think the classic example of that is you buy a pair of shoes and somebody wants to sell you some shoe polish,
right,
or some,
right,
shoe cleaner. These sort of things go together. And so it feels like that kind of service, as you say, that kind of attention can be very pleasant. It can be very, can feel very good. You know, it can go horribly wrong, but you can always ignore their recommendations,
right,
you know.
Right.
So it doesn't feel like it's overly intrusive, and it, right, feels like it probably gets it right enough times for you not to be too annoyed about it.
No, it does. But then I think, like, we need to look at Cory Doctorow's concept of enchidification, right? So when the recommendation system was first developed, yes, of course, there was always a financial aspect to it.
Sure.
But I mean, from my time at Amazon, a lot of the workers there were like genuinely into this whole like customer-centric thinking.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, so they were trying to do things that would be good for their customers. And I think what Amazon management was good at is what was kind of aligning that customer focus and making sure that it was also good for the business in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's just stipulate again that these recommender systems, the one at Amazon, was originally designed to really give the customer the best experience possible. And of course, drive sales. So that's also good.
Sure. These two things don't feel inherently bad or evil.
No, not really. But over time, the problem is that these recommender systems are black boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have been trained as a customer to trust these things from the beginning because they've been helpful to you, you know,
right,
the bookstore clerk is helpful to you. But all of a sudden, over time, the incentives can change, you know,
right,
and they're always kind of being tweaked in the favor of the company. So now, if you look at Amazon's recommender systems now, what they're trying to do is recommend to you sponsored products and, you know, all of this stuff. And it no longer is giving you the things that are the best deal or the things that actually it thinks you might be the most interested in, but it's giving you the things where it thinks this will do the most good for us, Amazon, the business.
Right,
if
right,
we can,
okay,
you know.
It's moved away from what appears to be a fairly neutral stance,
yeah,
into something which is more overt, maybe it's overtly, or maybe it's even covertly,
right,
probably more covertly in general, because I think most people don't don't think about this kind of stuff. So it's kind of moved into a more covert operation where, like you say, they're trying to push their own products more, or push products which will give them a greater profit.
Exactly. Yeah. And this happens slowly over time. And I think like the enchidification concept is a really important way to think about this. And we'll put in the show notes some links to Cory Doctorow's framework for enchidification. But one of the points he makes that I think is really important is that the enchidification doesn't require anybody to be actively evil in this process. Yeah. You know, there's a drive by the kind of capitalist system that pushes toward this enchidification, where ultimately everything that you do evolves toward the thing that makes the most money or builds the most power for this company.
The other example of this that it's been made public recently is the Spotify playlist stuff, where in the past Spotify would play you certain things that you liked,
right,
or that were sort of, again, neutral. And then more recently it's like, well, actually the cost of playing these tracks attracts like a lower benefit to the artist, or a lower licensing cost to Spotify. So they will put those things in the algorithm ahead of other things.
Right.
And on the back end, so that's kind of like taking advantage of the trust of the consumer. And on the other hand, I think part of this enchidification thing is saying, if you're now a monopsony, if you're a monopoly on the supply side, if you're a monopoly where you're the only place where businesses and artists can essentially showcase their work, in the case of Spotify, then that gateway power that those people have, you know, like Apple has this gateway power over the App Store.
Right.
So their ability to charge more and their ability to make more profits on both sides of the transaction, basically, where they can reduce the cost of serving the user and kind of degrade the user experience. That's what enchidification is, isn't it, essentially?
Yeah, exactly.
It's the degrading the consumer experience, while at the same time degrading the supplier experience as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's the thing where I feel like, personally, I've sort of seen that happen over time with these big systems, you know, like Google, like Amazon, and I've kind of dropped out.
Yeah.
I don't use those services anymore. I'll use more niche services. But a lot of people aren't in that situation. They just don't know how to escape. They don't know how to get out.
Yeah.
They don't know what the alternatives are. And I don't think that just saying, oh, you know, use a different search engine or use a different store is necessarily the answer to this problem. I mean, think, you know, it's a bit like saying eat less meat is the answer to the planetary crisis that we're in.
Right.
I mean, it might make you feel good, but it doesn't necessarily solve the problem. It doesn't even begin to solve the problem.
No.
Feeling good is always nice, you know.
Yeah.
So that is important.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
One should always make the best ethical decisions you can.
Sure.
But at the same time, I think the main issue that we want to try and get to here is that individual actions aren't necessarily going to be an answer to our ability to resist or to shape how technology is applied in the world.
Right.
Is that kind of like entering into the kind of space that you want to get into, Josh?
Yeah, I just 100%. I mean, I was nodding vigorously here. listeners couldn't see that, of course. Yeah, I think that's spot on. You know, we've been told to vote with our wallet, right? That's the solution to all problems. You know, if you don't like the way Microsoft does business, you know, vote with your wallet and buy Apple instead, whatever. I do believe, like you said, trying to live your life in accordance with your values and make ethical choices, like that is a wonderful thing. However, individual action cannot address any of this. Like, we need collective action.
Yeah.
We absolutely need that. And I think like the people who are the forces who are arrayed against us, the 1% to quote Bernie Sanders, I believe this is very intentional. You know, that they are kind of selling us this idea that, you know, you, the individual, it's your responsibility. you just buy a Prius and all of a sudden you're kind of off the hook for global warming or a Tesla or whatever. Let's look at the neoliberal economist's favorite word, which is externalities, right? The growth of AI. Again, the same old story that, you know, that the cost of providing this service is set based on something, but the total cost to society, well, that's just an externality, right? Like we don't have to pay, you know, the oil company doesn't have to pay for the cost of cleaning up the pollution or, you know, all the damage done by superstorms. So what are your thoughts on that? What are some of the externalities of AI we should be keeping our eye on?
I think most people kind of know what the externalities are. They know that they're a kind of like the amount of power that AI consumes is incredibly large. And obviously that at the time of a climate emergency and a climate apocalypse that we're entering, this feels like, it feels crazy, basically.
Yeah.
To be committing to use so much of our resources to do something which, you know, coming back to the trust in terms of the claims, I think we're skeptical of, to say the least.
Yeah.
So I think it's good to go through these externalities because we can at least get some people on our side in terms of agreement on that side of things. Yeah. So let's start with just the energy, obviously. I mean, this is really, really bad news for the planet.
It is.
Bad news in terms of like the most countries, even industrial policies. What's happening here is that a lot of these tech companies, I think in the tech companies in the 90s were seen as like our friends who were doing the right thing.
Yeah.
They were moving towards solar panels and clean energy and all this kind of stuff. It all felt good.
Yeah.
But, and we didn't know about the footprint of their data centers and all this kind of stuff.
I think that's a really important point because I think with the shift to the cloud, what an amazing marketing term the cloud is, right? Because the cloud doesn't exist. It's just this beautiful, magical thing that you send data into.
It's above the earth, yeah.
Yeah, it's above the earth. But the cloud is, as you said, with the rise of cloud computing, these data centers got bigger and bigger and, you know, the data centers are no different than the factories of the 19th century. These are things that you mentioned massive energy use, absolutely. So one kind of positive thing is over the last, I believe, 10 or 15 years, we've brought like an astounding amount of renewable energy generation online. Mm. Unfortunately, all that's done is kept up with the demand. So we are burning just as much fossil fuels as we were 10 years ago, despite how much clean energy. Yeah, maybe more. Yeah. And, you know, obviously with these data center expansion, which is being driven by AI, at least that's kind of the marketing maneuver being used. They're even talking about turning back on nuclear power plants. Calling nuclear power plants clean is kind of a stretch.
Mm,
there are reasonable debates to be had, so let's not get too far into that. But I think also a thing that most people are not aware of is not only is it power usage, but it's also an enormous amount of fresh water being required to cool these data centers, which is another thing that it's not a limitless resource. So that's the kind of environment piece. Is there more to say there?
I was going to say about the water aspect is a slight aside, but there was a very famous case of, and this, it's still going on, this like Flint, Michigan, the water story there, where the water was polluted, not for this AI data center stuff.
No, years ago.
It was polluted for other corrupt reasons. But what was interesting about that story from this perspective was that the Ford Motor Company had a factory near Flint, Michigan, and they were allowed to take the clean water because it was affecting their production, whereas the humans weren't. And we're now in certain situations in the world where data centers are given priority over water than humans.
Yeah.
Even if you're like a major climate skeptic, and you think that we can tech our way out of this or whatever, you know, or that maybe we'll survive it in a sort of proximate state to where we are now for the next 1,000 years. Great. Okay. Even taking that to one side, you know, the very fact that we're prioritizing these things, these inhuman things, these just industrial things over human beings is a huge problem, I think.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of their, and we know that their climate, they're a problem for the climate. This is proven. But even if you, even taking that out of the conversation, you know, steel manning it, let's say,
yeah,
then it would still be a problem. I think the other problem that we see is that I'm not a great fan or a great believer that individual companies' climate targets are plausible,
right,
or believable or reachable.
Right.
But the very fact that most of those companies, like the four or five or six large tech companies, have all abandoned their climate targets is quite staggering, I think.
That is, yeah.
You know, so it's already having, like, in terms of externality, the whole concept of AI is having a massive impact on these targets and these the requirements of the energy grids in the world, which is outpacing the last technology stuff that was a waste of energy.
Cryptocurrency, yeah.
Which is making a comeback as well, you know?
Yeah,
these things do seem to be incredibly wasteful of very, very scarce and important resources that we're meant to be reducing. So I think that's the most obvious externality that we can see.
Yeah. So I think another big one is copyright. And I actually want to leave that one for a second, put a pin in it, and talk about one that maybe is not as obvious, because the environmental things we can see, copyright, people are starting to see the issues. But one of the things that I think flies under the radar is what it actually takes to train these LLMs, these large language models. So what happens effectively is you build a model and then you do something called reinforcement training, which basically is the model spits out some stuff, human beings look at it and say whether this is a good result or not. And that's fed back into the model, which is then trained. And there is a lot of human labor involved in training these large language models. And that human labor typically is conducted in countries with very low wages, with poor labor regulation. Kenya is one that we've heard of that's been in the news. And this work is, it's grueling. It can be actually traumatic because remember, like, OpenAI at least has a kind of safety mode on ChatGPT where it won't give you back certain content, or, you know, it won't generate images of terrible things. But what that means is that human beings have had to look at all those horrible things and tell the machine, hey, this is horrible. Like, don't show it to people. You know, so I think this is just a thing that a lot of people completely overlook, that there is human labor being used in the production of these models. And those are, again, like kind of like 19th century factory conditions.
Right,
like, it's really terrible, long hours, low paid in the service of the machine.
Yeah, I think the final one that might be worth addressing is the fact that let's say that you have a bunch of works. I mean, my son is an artist, and if he publishes his work online, copyrighted or not, the robots are assumed to, you know, assumed that that is free for them to consume and give absolutely no compensation to him and no attribution. So I think those are the sort of things. Now, let's put up, do we want to talk about copyright in a separate episode? Maybe
go
into a bit of a deeper dive.
Yeah, I think we can do a deeper dive, but, you know, maybe we can just quickly kind of outline.
Sure.
You know, like, one interesting thing for me is these AI companies are on one hand not attributing or compensating people for the work that goes into training them. And I think it's interesting to note that sometimes this work can come straight out the other end unchanged at all, right? It's not a case that the models are necessarily synthesizing all of this stuff and giving you an original creation of the machine, but sometimes they're giving you the actual text, you know, that a writer wrote, or the actual painting that your son did, whatever. So they're not doing that. And in fact, they're claiming that it would be prohibitively expensive for us to be able to identify, to be able to respect copyright, to be able to, you know, any of these things. It would be so prohibitively expensive. So therefore, we shouldn't be required to do it.
Yeah.
You know, which is, again, a classic externality, right?
Yeah.
So that's one side of it.
Yeah, I think the other thing, I mean, and again, maybe this is kind of like the smallest violin in the world, is where DeepSeek came along and essentially redid their work and used a lot less compute power,
right,
and got similar, if not better, results than the OpenAI model.
Right.
But the smallest violin came out because the CEO was saying that this was plagiarism, that this was terrible, you know, that somebody had taken their work and used it.
Exactly.
And hence the small violin, because, you know, no one was sympathetic to this perspective when he has essentially raided the entire world's intellectual property.
Right.
I think what's interesting about it, and we've talked about this before, and it's something that we should maybe do a little bit of a deeper dive in, is that technology in general hasn't always been something which is beyond the reach of regulation or even kind of like self-regulation, let's say, or some kind of ethical board. So for example, you know, human embryonic experimentation is something which is largely outlawed. You know, you're not allowed to merge human embryos with sheep embryos, for example, and come out with, you know, whatever you want. I think the concept of regulating technology or regulating science, for want of a more broad umbrella, is nothing new.
No.
You know, we're completely capable of regulating science and technology. But the owners of these companies are, you know, and we've seen this recently with JD Vance coming to Europe and telling us that we're not allowed to regulate social media platforms, and they will not be allowing us to regulate AI platforms.
Right.
This is why, you know, this current moment is so important for us to discuss the application ownership and the way in which we can talk around how AIs are applied, used, and what it means to resist at a very high level. Because it's definitely a moment where the owners and the proponents of this technology want everything to be completely unleashed, unbridled, and unrestricted. And that is a very dangerous place for the world, I think.
Yeah, 100%. I think that is a really great preview of what's to come on this season of Politics. We want to dig into these things and think them through. And I think it's really important to say, yes, we've set out our stall. We have revealed ourselves as Luddites. You know, we're using this lens of critical technology thinking, but we are trying to operate in good faith here. We're trying to engage with steel man arguments in favor of things. You know, we don't want to just attack, you know, kind of logical fallacies and prove we're right. We want to really talk through the stuff and acknowledge, like you said at the beginning, that there are some genuinely beneficial applications of the technology under the AI umbrella.
Yes.
It's not too much for us to demand that those beneficial applications be put front and center.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see you next week on the podcast as we dive deeper into some of these thorny issues that we've just hinted at in this week's conversation.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. Thanks very much, Josh.
Thank you, Ray.
This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Politechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you've given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@politechs.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Politechs on Blue Sky and at Politechs at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is politechs.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!